This is part two of a live, interactive public philosophy event in Göteborg, Sweden. I hope you're enjoying it as much as we did. A huge thank to the audience. So brave, so open, so fabulous. Thank you. You can find out more about the Philosophical Practice Collective Life Examined on Facebook or Meetup. Type in Life Examined Sweden. And you can listen to the other episodes of this Semitic Philosophy series on philoprax.se, that's philoprax.se. Look for articles and podcasts in the menu tab.
When you talk about the body is constantly transforming and changing and ambiguous. And there's a sense of alterity there. And I think that's...
Is all philosophy Semitic?
Well, no, I don't know.
But, I mean, what would you teach in a Semitic philosophy class? You can have like 20th century philosophy class, and what's a Semitic philosophy class? Like, what's the curriculum for?
But how did you come up with the idea of Semitic philosophy? Was it this the image of the thinker and thinking that is too narrow?
Something like that. And also the experience of, like, when I had my big crisis 7 years ago. Seven is an important number, you know, it's like my time now. So going to yoga and Pilates classes and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you go to, I had never ever been working out ever in my entire life before. And then the yoga teacher says something like, feel your roots go through the floor and down to the earth.
Yeah.
And then you go like, oh, I'll obey. You know, I'll try to actually feel my roots go through them. And then you do that and something really cool and profound happens.
Yeah, but that is your imagination. Because you have no roots that can go through you into the ground.
Well,
that
not that we can see with our eyes.
That's great work for you.
Yeah.
It can be really helpful.
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen. You don't get roots from your feet down into the ground.
No.
But the ground comes up and supports you.
Yes, when I'm sitting.
Sitting, standing, doing whatever.
Yeah.
And
that's
something also that we don't think about.
Yeah.
That we have the connection to the world, to the earth that holds us.
But it was kind of like a full body presence. That's what I meant.
I would like Erasmus, I want to ask you about imagination. Because you brought this up. This is good. Imagination related to the body.
Well, visualization, maybe I should say.
Yeah.
Can you say a bit about that?
What did you say, that word?
Maybe it's visualization. Maybe I should know.
Visualization.
Maybe it's visualization.
Or maybe illusion.
Illusion, yeah.
Wow. So
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Erasmus. Or, Christopher, take it away.
I'm happy to try to respond. I would believe that the single most important influential formative experience that is the foundation of all life that is to follow would be the very first interaction between your body, yourself, and the body, the self of the other who will nurture you.
Mm.
Okay? And if we are to believe certain theories, this is where the self is born, this is where the person is born. The little child, the infant, will have a need, a physical need. All our needs initially are physical, yeah? I'm hungry, for example. And there will be an impulse to look for the breast. Okay? And the well-attuned mother, who knows the needs of her baby, will make available this breast at the right moment. Okay? And this will create, I believe, in the baby the illusion that I created this breast and what it stands for.
Mm-hmm.
I made this. And that gives a very first, very important sense of agency.
Mm.
I am, I make. So the first sense of I am comes through, is born through the perception of I create, I make through my body.
Mm.
I fulfill the physical need through grabbing, through sucking, yeah?
Mm.
And we find very often in the field where I work that severe pathologies perhaps begin very, very early. They are somehow linked to very early experiences of dysfunctional relationships. The baby was not cared for properly. The mother was suffering from postpartum depression. Something like this, yeah? Body-to-body, person-to-person, self-to-self interaction takes place nicely, it goes smoothly, there will be a very, very good foundation to build upon. So this would be perhaps a very first kind of wisdom that will give a certain kind of epistemological trust. This world has something to offer me. I have needs, and the world has something to offer me. The needs can be met. So you see, in attachment theory and other things, it can quite easily be witnessed in the clinic, so to speak, how extremely fundamental, essential this process is. Body to body, mind to mind, soul to soul, self to self. At first they are one, and then there is a kind of separation. I am. I have been created through my body, through the body of the other. And the illusion then is that initially I am the maker of all things. Yeah, this gives a sense of agency.
Yeah, yeah. That reminds me of the philosopher Merleau-Ponty says, it's not I think, it's I can.
Mm-hmm.
That the self has an aim, it's aiming for, which is carried out on the sight of the body. The body is the sight by which this aim is carried out. And that is where thought happens, is in the process of achieving aims through physical embodiment in relation to others in a physical context, which includes things like culture and language and stages.
But maybe the child doesn't think, it doesn't have an awareness in that way, with words, I guess. I mean, it's an awareness, but sort of so.
Mm.
So how that would be a construct to say. I mean, I think it is like that, but it will be beyond words.
Mm. Before words.
Before words.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And when you see severely disturbed patients or people, you will see that their expression of their disorder is very often pre-verbal. They will be disconnected, disembodied. They won't feel their legs. They will suffer from partial paralysis. Yeah, it's medically unexplainable. You will see them being totally disconnecting from any sexual urge. There will be this rupture between body and mind, and they are really limited to the mind part of the self. So they don't have full self. So it's a pathology of the self that always, almost always, has a very clear correlation to the body.
Mm. That's how it starts the somatic philosophy class. It starts with the personhood and the always, the sense of self that is always bodily, kind of.
Which class?
The somatic philosophy class.
Very hypothetical.
This is the visualization.
At the Institute. Yeah.
At the Institute, yeah.
Yeah.
Miriam's writing a syllabus now.
Yeah. And I think so much about the body that we're, you know, from we're children to we are 6-7 years old, we move, we play, we're in our bodies, and then we start going to school, and it all becomes in the mind. And we're trained, that's the main way we're trained, we sit on chairs with desks, and it's not really talking about somatics, that's not really somatics, it's just training the mind function, and that's why I think so much yoga and all these body-mind practices today have become so overpopulated. People are in need because they have illnesses, you know, they're unexplained, they're not listening. I think that a big part of illnesses today also is because we are neglecting the body, and we just
keep
running our lives through our mind.
So, but, that's a good point. How would you connect reconnecting to the body more as being important for the pursuit of wisdom?
Like like you were saying, the body keeps the score. That's the book. Yeah, I also have that at home. I think that if you learn so much by reading and taking in what's from the outside, but if you're practicing, learning, listening to what's happening physically, and you're really in tune with that, then that will be your wisdom, and that will tell you, okay, I'm not feeling so well here and there, and maybe you know yourself more and more, and it's a practice, because a practice that most people don't really do today. But if you know how to practice that, then you know you will be able to heal or learn about your own body more in depth than you would if you didn't have that kind of practice, and you would know what to do about it. I mean, seek help, or what do I need? You know that physical instant kind of, oh, I need to do this or I need to do that, and not just think, oh, I have to go work out because. But my body really feels like doing this or that, or I'm sick or whatever.
Well, so to answer your question about, or my interpretation of the question anyway, like how like embodiment or using the body can help you philosophize better. Perhaps some of you have read the book by Anders Hansen, Jernstark, about physical exercise and how it helps you solve problems. I mean, that seems applicable to what we do. But also being embodied, like realizing, not just intellectually, but like feeling that you are a mortal animal is going to influence your moral values, for instance, how you interact with other people. Like if you really, really understood how much of an animal that's currently dying right now, you'd probably change your ways, like in some way, at least. I wouldn't be drinking as much coffee if I really knew. But like coffee takes me out.
Coffee was good for you, though.
Yeah, it is.
Is it?
And they've changed again.
Is that
at least 4 cups per day?
4 cups.
Oh,
yeah.
4.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm almost good.
It seems like you're connecting. I think to you're looking at asking the question: if we in teaching and learning in gaining knowledge, there's an existential component of it, which is embodied. I'm thinking about Aristotle, the Peripatetics. They used to do philosophy by walking around together.
Yeah.
That's an interesting model of doing philosophy. Maybe we should all get up and walk around Gothenburg and do this. But I mean, one of the most influential teaching experiences I had was when I was able to lead a class in Washington State. We did philosophy and we climbed a mountain. And that doesn't mean that we went any easier light on the philosophical concepts. It was incredibly difficult philosophy, but it was done in the context of climbing a mountaintop. And the students left that class, I think, more impacted than any other class they've had before.
Wonderful.
Because now we have suddenly a bodily interaction. I'm getting at what you're talking about. This is a bodily interaction with knowledge that is much more than sitting in a dark room trying to learn grammar or philosophical concepts or dates and names of philosophers, right? It suddenly has some existential import, which is embodied. I mean, it has to be embodied, right? Sorry.
Yeah, I just want to add to what you said. Like, I always think that when I'm a thinker, as you all, I guess, and when I'm in the bus, like for long bus rides, I always think the best. And I thought a bit about that. Why do I think best in the bus? And I think it's kind of like I'm moving in my body, and then it's also easier for my mind to move forward.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Nice.
That's my thought. I don't know.
It's a good illustration of movement being both a mental movement and a physical movement.
Because if I think I stay here for an hour,
you get stuck in the thought.
Yeah, at some point I will get stuck. Maybe I get I get to some point, but it's not, and there it stops.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, that you need to move. I think this is very good. Trick, you know, that you need to.
Didn't someone say, like, never trust a thought that occurs indoors?
I don't know if anybody should have said that. If not, that's yours.
Name it.
That's yours.
I think it was someone else.
Curious point about riding the bus. It's one of the times that we are both at rest in some sense, but if you've got a lot of things to do, you are, for the time being, not responsible for the fact that you can't do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're at peace with the fact that you're not focusing on the things that are on your to-do list.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of it's a frame of mind you might not be in the rest of
your
life. So maybe
like the airport bus, this is my favorite moment. It's getting on it. So I can't do anything.
I was just going to say, so it might be a social disservice to have internet on trains and buses and so on.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I have an example of body, soul, mind.
Mm-hmm.
This winter in Texas, I teach preschool, and it's a Christian preschool.
Mm-hmm.
And so I walk, I pray to the Lord, tell me what I should teach these kids. And while I'm walking, I always came up with ideas.
Yeah, so easy.
And I would take them back in the classroom, and they worked.
Mm.
So all three together.
So I should. What should I put about the movement, walking? Like, what should I put? Something very important.
Peripatetic.
I agree.
What?
Creating wisdom creates movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and vice versa, movement helps create wisdom.
That's true.
can we make one?
Meditation is static.
Almost simple explanation through this, because if we are moving, our body produces. Our body moves around adrenaline a lot, much more. So,
but not on the bus.
Not on the bus. No, but I think change in movement. I think change in movement.
Change
in movement changes consciousness. And I mean, one of the things, if you want to get rid of anxiety, is do lots of exercise because it lowers your adrenaline.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I think it's a pretty rational explanation to that why this happens.
Mm.
So you sort of how changes in exercise level change consciousness.
Mm.
So either sort of make you sort of think less or think more or something like that.
Mm.
So I think that is connected. One other aspect which I also wonder is that with you do need a neural framework for thinking in the first place. So if you're neural framework changes, your thinking changes, and your the way you look at the world changes.
Mm. Can you explain neural framework?
Most practical things, brain injuries change personality. So everybody knows that, and you look at sort of at the psychological effect, but it's also effectively it's a way of thinking. So how you perceive the world and how you think about the world.
Mm.
So your whole idea of that's very often we sort of accept that the body changes, so we grow and then we get old and these sort of things. But the mind changes in the same way, just by the very merit that it sits on that framework, which changes.
Mm.
And it goes the other way, right?
It goes the other way.
So mental practices
can
change the body. But can we make one more? Because we've got a lot of great comments now, descriptions of how the body interacts in helpful ways. But what I'm curious about is, how does it contribute to pursuing wisdom? Because it might just be that, I'm going to be the devil's advocate for a second, right? Argue the other side. It might just be that doing exercises, moving and so on, is more effective in some ways of getting us to pursue our wants. But that's not necessarily wisdom. So how does it connect then to a pursuit of wisdom if philosophy is the pursuit of wisdom?
Talked about intuition.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
Mm.
what about intuition?
Say more.
Say more.
Take it away. Go for it. Yeah, yeah. Intuition. Good.
No, but I think that at least I trust my intuition quite a lot.
Yeah.
Perhaps more than my rational thinking.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you philosophers.
Uh-huh. Shame on you.
Not be explained, or maybe you can explain it after a while when you think about it, but some things you just know, and then you have to think about it for a while. Why do I think this, or why do I feel this so strongly? So it could be that the mind is behind, and you will figure out after a while why.
And so what is intuition?
Where is it?
That is a good question. I guess it's somehow perceptions that you get, sometimes unconsciously, I don't know, but you somehow you get a feeling about something.
Yeah.
Is intuition
through
somatic?
Your senses.
It's somatic.
Yeah.
It's
yes,
somatic.
Intuition.
I would
absolutely
say it's somatic.
Yeah.
Cool.
Don't you think it's the mass of everything that you have
of course,
sort of
it's the
perceived your whole life.
Yeah.
It's in the bottom of
yeah.
your
well,
yeah.
you have to build on what you know, obviously.
Yeah.
So it's
so
interrelated.
Both body and mind and thoughts.
Yeah.
And something
as a philosopher, I'm thinking intuitions can be very good, but I also want to say we have to be very critical of intuitions because, for what I was talking about before, the way in which our intuitions can be influenced by forces that we're not necessarily consciously
yeah.
aware of. I mean, I live in Lund. I used to work in Copenhagen. I would take the train across after the border control was put in, and one time I took the train across, and they come and ask for they asked for a driver's license. And you don't have to be a Swedish citizen to have a driver's license. So they would just ask certain people for driver's license, right? And not other people. And I thought this was really interesting. And I got a little upset by this. So I asked, I actually got off the train and let the train go and missed my train. And I went up to the police officer and I said, how do you know who to ask for a driver's license? And she said, you'll go after me in magkänsla. I go after my gut feeling. And I said, okay, thank you. What is informing your gut feeling?
Yeah.
And this is what I want to say, because on the one hand, being an expert police officer, you should be able to pick up through your training, practice, habituation, your skills, you should be able to say, that person seems suspicious, I'm going to ask them. But then there's part of me that's saying, we live in a very contentious time with immigration issues and a lot of hot button stuff going on there with undertones of nationalism and racism, and I'm wondering,
I don't know if there's ever been a
but is that in some sense informing our gut feeling, right? And so as a philosopher, then I want to be critical and say, okay, respect that you're an expert as a police officer, hoping you're an expert, but also being critical of, well, there's other forces at work in our culture that makes me say intuition can be very good.
Yeah.
But I want to be very skeptical of it at the same time, right?
Of course, it's problematic
yeah.
as well. Yes.
What was her answer to how she decides?
She just said, I go after my gut feeling, and that was it, and like no more discussion.
Yeah.
I think it is becoming very problematic if you are on a level in the society when you have power, for example, deciding over people and letting the gut feeling direct you when it comes to this.
Right.
I think I'm afraid of gut feeling.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
It's interesting we even say gut feeling. I mean, we talk about a bodily response, right?
Yeah, you know, my gut feeling is saying that this person should not have this money, for example.
Mm.
But in some ways, everything we've said so far is that we need to pay attention to the gut more, right? Like, this should help us with wisdom. So we've got
I'm
a bit of attention
of the wisdom
now.
And what is wisdom? And I'm thinking wisdom is also, I'm into this context, that maybe the fourth thing we are talking about, if we have mind, soul, body,
yeah.
I would like to add context.
Yeah.
And context is also floating over time.
Mm.
If we talk about diagnosis, for example, like autism and stuff like that, it depends on time.
Yeah.
Now we are living in a time when we have truths. It's saying an autistic person is functioning like this and cannot do this and is driven by these and these forces, but that is now. Like in hundreds of years, I don't think that it will be the same talks.
There'll be a different discourse.
If we go 100 years back, there was definitely not this kind of reasoning. So I'm skeptical about when it comes gut feelings also, because that is also contextual.
But I cut you off, Pernilla, because I think you had something really good with intuition and wisdom. I think you say more about that. I rudely cut you off.
No problem at all. It's just
there's more there.
I'm not sure there is, but I think that we wouldn't be able to reason and we wouldn't be able to sit here and talk about anything if we didn't have our bodies and didn't interact with our bodies all the time. Like our eyes and hearing and everything that we perceive, consciously or unconsciously. So I guess for me it's very clear that you get the wisdom through different sources. And one way is certainly to talk about things and discuss things, but also what we sense.
Mm. I would think that somatic wisdom, one thing is to maybe say now that Maybe it's time to stand up and walk around.
Yeah, you're right.
It's kind of...
yeah, that would be somatically
wise. Because
that
is to listen to yourself, to your intuition, to your body, to your mind. Everything together is to sort of know that, well, now we've probably been sitting too long, the chair is not that good.
Yeah.
So maybe it's good to sort of take some more wine. Yes.
Yes.
And can I connect that something Rasmus said, because I thought this was really good, that if the goal of philosophy is to pursue truth, and also I think... in my view of philosophy is it should lead to human flourishing. If we want to hold a view of the body and philosophy like we're doing, this would give us a lot of impetus and reason to fight for certain justice programs, things that would help fight against injustice, that would help, say, mother-child bonding, that would help father-child bonding, that would fight against childhood poverty, things that would prevent the embodied connections that are necessary for us to thrive as human beings. That seems to be a project towards truth and wisdom, I would even say wisdom, that that this view of embodiment would give us the push to do that, or the tools to do that, or the reason to do that. At least a good way to give an argument to people for why we need these sort of things.
And there's another aspect to it as well, is we need to credit intuition and the body for a lot of the work that it does. Like, in a way, it's a sort of like implicit knowledge, like thousands of hours of experience of a certain thing that just pops up in your mind. And you can make an expert decision. Like chess players, for instance, they don't always rationally decide on what to do. Sometimes it can just, you know, appear. This is the solution. And because it is, there are too many variables to consciously process. But your brain and your body does it for you. There is also the aspect that you can't rationally decide on certain things. It's impossible to decide, should I rationally stay at home or go to live examine tonight?
Always live examined. It's never really an issue, is it?
But for every other decision that you're making, when you have two almost equally good options, if you're only judging it rationally, you cannot make a decision. Because
you'll be deciding and deciding and deciding and then your life is over.
And some people actually have a disease where they can't choose based on emotions. So if you give them two good options, where like one is good in this way and the other is good in that way, well, like for lunch, where should I go for lunch? Well, this place, it's not as popular, so you'll get a seat. But this place is really popular, so the food is good. But then again, this place, and they'll just go back and forth. You can't have them decide, because there is no emotion attached to the choice.
But isn't only slightly two different types of decision? I mean, one is the decision, I mean, there's the intuition, which basically says, I know something is true without having gone through a conscious process. So, I mean, intuition can be a bit like thinking out of sight. So our sight as being the consciousness. I think it's a bit the thing of this Daniel Kahneman's sort of stratifying of this different type of thinking. There's this one which is absolutely necessary for our survival, that we have with our senses, we take all this information in and then we process it, and this process is not a conscious process. And then there's
we jump out of the way of the speeding car.
So that's the sort of thing. But there's also a rationality behind that, and it's also a learned process. It's a cultural context process. But then there's also the gap feeling, which is the thing to know what is good for you, or what connects you to something, which is not, can be also irrational. And I think for things like deciding whether you go to life examined or stay at home, that is something which I would also call it intuition, because you call it that way, but I think it's a different type of thing. It's maybe something which comes even deeper.
Maybe, I mean, can we talk about passion? I mean, Kierkegaard talks about when you're making a rational decision, you can always give reasons for different things. And he says that rationality has what he calls an inner infinity. It will, by itself, never come to an end. And for him, that's why it's very important that passion is involved, which is also a bodily phenomenon of passion, that we have to then make a passionate existential commitment to, screw it, I'm going to go to this place, even though the food is apparently horrible, but I'm just going to believe in this choice and go eat there. And that's a passionate existential commitment, and that's also a bodily phenomenon.
Just can I just say we've got 10 minutes left, so right?
Yes, but we are running out of space, so very say a very small thing that I can write.
I wasn't going to say anything. Well, I had a lot to say, but I was just saying we only have 10 minutes left, so we can take a break in just a second, and we can get up and move around.
Yeah,
what were you saying?
We need to do that.
I was going to talk about one of your examples, and you said maybe there's slightly suspicious examples. I mean, playing chess is kind of really interesting, right? Because sense that chess players play chess intuitively, and that makes them do such a better job than they would by simply enumerating all the possibilities, is true of human chess players. And it's one of the reasons that people believe for so long that it would not be possible to play chess without replicating human intuition.
Mm.
But then suddenly we realize that that's just not true. Right?
Which part's not true?
It's just not true.
Which
right?
part?
So it is quite possible for something that is not particularly embodied to play chess very well.
A computer, okay, yeah.
Without
yeah, gotcha.
Making intuitive steps simply by enumerating things like a fairly poor chess player, but doing that well.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a disappointing discovery for us. I wonder how many of these other things, the same kind of things, will kind of come up that will go, really, as embodied humans, we've got to have all of this kind of cultural context, we've got to get up and walk around, we've got to catch the bus or whatever in order to have good thoughts. But in 100 years' time, I'll find out that, disappointingly,
Harari.
There's a device that sits on my desk and also has good thoughts.
I'm thinking
and
Harari.
And it can work more than 8 hours a day, and it kind of doesn't need to worry about whether the coffee is kind of just right or too much.
But the Sapiens, the Yuval Harari writer, wrote the book Sapiens, and he has this talk where he says, what will we do when the computers are better than us at all these things, like driving taxis is his example, I think, and building everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, not every taxi driver can be a yoga teacher. And yoga being like one thing that a supposedly a robot wouldn't be very good at, like understanding what the class needs right now. Or
stretch your legs now.
Yeah,
well, I would contest that, actually.
Exactly.
I think if you think it's just a matter of information.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
the real danger. That's the more
that's the assumption.
Computers can get,
that's the assumption.
The better they get on
reduction.
The predictions.
Yeah.
Reductionistic.
Yeah.
But can I just point out one other cool thing about chess?
Yeah.
So, evidently, when top-level chess players are playing chess, you can do investigation of what's going on in their body, and there's very similar, all the same hormones and chemicals are going on that you would see in a creature that is being chased, a prey being chased. Right? So you have the same physiological reaction to a hunting situation going on when you are just thinking. So I mean, just to say that, like, the mind, the thinking part also, right, it instigates, it uses all of these parts of our body that...
Yeah, like we said at the beginning, speech is corporeal.
Yeah.
There was this research, I think we talked about that during the course,
mm-hmm.
I read about people were called in to answer questions about something, and all the questions, they had to read things about people and then answer questions, and the people who were described in these questions were all a bit old, they were tired, they were stressed, they had difficulty in walking and things like that. And the real research was to watch, well, I think maybe it wasn't real research, but it became a part of research, because when all these people left the room, they walked in a completely different way.
Yeah.
They were walking like they were very tired and all that. So everything that you
that's
read
one of the studies
and think
that is failing to replicate.
Mm.
Yeah.
So
so you can see that how that affected you.
Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes.
Oh, it's bored. It was interesting.
It is very interesting.
Boo,
yes.
Truth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Boo. But just a point on the chess and AI topic is that as of yet, the winners in these studies are AI human teams. Yet. Yeah, exactly. We'll see like beyond human level creativity in chess soon.
One of the issues with AI that has a really difficult time with social cues. So in certain things, it works really well, like in chess, for example. But if we want to talk about virtue ethics, for example, being in a social context when through my embodied engagement with this context, I practice what it means to be virtuous so that eventually I become an expert at being courageous, that I just simply, as Aristotle says, I simply know how to act at the right way at the right time in the right moment.
Yeah.
That might be a little more difficult for robots, if not impossible. I don't know, based on how robots, AI can read social context. But I think that's a, like when you brought up chess, I immediately thought of virtue ethics, and I thought that's also a way of embodiment can lead us to wisdom. If we can, in our embodied form, learn how to be courageous, for example, well, then I think we've got a pretty good thing going on if we're put in context where then we react in a courageous way.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to talk about intuition, it sounds like intuition is something that comes relatively quick. You embody it pretty quickly. And I'm just wondering if that isn't the completeness of us, where the spirit or the soul within us comes forward and doesn't allow the mind to actually work through all the problems and just says, go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I retired from the lumber business in 2007, and I had this intuition, and I didn't have facts to this, but I had this intuition that there was something coming that I should get out of the lumber business and retire.
Mm.
And in 2008, we had the big financial crash in America where the housing just kapoom, it went down through the floor, and the stock market, you know, came down half of what it was. And the intuition within me said, no, sell your stocks now, which investors are saying, well, no, you don't sell your stocks. Stocks are going up so fast. Why would you sell?
Mm-hmm.
But my intuition told me, get out.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a mental thing that made my physical thing do it. It was just an intuition. And I take it as the spirit or the soul or whatever within me telling me to make this move. It was an intuition. So it was like, you know, the physical and the mental, everything was embodied by the completeness of all three parts working together to make it a complete person, me.
Mm.
Mm. Very interesting.
The self, the self, yeah.
Yeah, the self, I think, is the totality of your being, right? So the intuition or the impulse, perhaps,
yeah,
is the point of convergence between body and mind, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The spontaneous gesture, someone said. It's an interesting concept. That which feels so natural, that which seems purely you.
Mm.
This way I express myself. It's wholly me.
Authentic.
Mm. Whenever you feel fully authentic, I believe you'll reach the conclusion, if you look at it, that the body and mind are they're doing it together. That's
yeah.
When we feel authentic.
There's a harmony.
So then
equilibrium.
No.
Maybe just
we need to
just one more.
No.
Okay.
So, but then there's one further question, right, which we haven't quite got to yet, which is you can be fully authentic and do something with your whole self, and yet the question still remains whether or not what you do is wise.
Yeah.
Right? So because something is fully authentic, it definitely doesn't mean it's either right or wise. So there's still some. That's great, because that means we can have more time.
Yeah, good. It's excellent to finish off with a question.
Yeah.
So when we look at this, we have.
I was going to say, whose eyes are we judging wisdom?
Wise.
Well, that's
yeah.
Is wisdom being successful? I mean, if I had made the same decision and I'd have gotten out, and all of a sudden the market would have kept going way up,
right.
You know, was that a wise move? Or.
Unlucky,
you know, in terms
maybe.
Of financially, no.
Unlucky,
but in terms of, you know, being at rest with what my decision was.
Yeah,
So
I mean, there's a lot more that could be discussed, which is good.
Yeah.
Mm.
You want to sum up, and then we can.
Yes, I'll sum this up. My dear panel, you haven't even seen what's been going on here.
No.
Oh,
this,
wow!
Yeah.
This
looks exciting, though.
No? Yeah, all these colors, beautiful.
Yeah.
So we started with a long introduction where I was blabbing on about Semitic philosophy and why I wanted to understand what it was. And then we came to this body-mind distinction. I've written narrative. I can't really remember where that came from. But we had this body-mind distinction like traditionally in philosophy, where the body must be subdued and the mind is the only important thing. But we quickly sort of walked into the mind being, is the mind a function? And if so, if the mind as an AI mind. And then we also have the concept of the soul versus impulses. So this is another way of distinguishing them. But then the distinction suddenly becomes a complete illusion. We don't have the problem anymore. And the big question that I put in the middle, which I love, and that's the next question that I love. What is a person? What is a person? I love that. When I was pregnant, only last year, I looked down at my big belly and I thought, there is a person. There's a person in my belly. And it's such a profound, wonderful feeling and knowledge and insight. You know, I'm carrying this person. Anyway, so this, what is a person? The sudden non-distinction between body and mind, and the presence of both in the togetherness, and the way speech is corporeal and not a mental separated from the body activity. The body here is also the seat of aims and striving. When Rasmus was talking about the baby, and the baby that in the sense where we have, I'm jumping a little bit now, we have the embodied processes and the constant relationality of the self, the formation of the self and the body, always with other, the other person, the other person and other people. So the self has this sense of creative agency in the body from like the first hour of life, if everything goes well. We also asked the question whether, I always said that the body informs me, but how and what? And then we kind of sort of left that a little bit, because it's not like the body informs me, but it's more a sense of I am informed, and I am interpreting the information I am getting. It's all me, it's all the person. The question is really, what is a person? The question, that is really what we're talking, we weren't talking about, but yeah. So from there we think, is all philosophy somatic, since this is the sense of something?
How many thousand years did it take?
It took less than an hour
to that conclusion.
But we're also smart. Oh, the contextual. Not done it. Please. Soma is contextual, I've written too. And intuition is somatic. Movement and change in the body is also in the mind. It's like it all comes together in this. Where we started with what is somatic philosophy, thinking that maybe all philosophy is somatic, but also having an understanding of selfhood and personhood as being definitely not like having a body, but it's so difficult to talk about these things.
Being a body.
Yeah.
The body is the site by which our existential life is lived.
Site or seat or position.
That's true.
Well, it's obvious we need part two at some point.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much, dear panel.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm going to put on the music again, and we can mingle and get up.
Drink more wine for the bodily part.
Yeah, for the intuition.
Hey, but a glass of wine does help philosophy.
Yes. It is hard to talk about. In part two, maybe we should use another type of communication, like a non-language communication. I don't even know what I mean anymore. Well, see you around.